under a good microscope, or at least a high gain set of magnifying glass, if you know what I mean, with the right kind of lighting, you may be pleasantly surprised to find out there already is the connector on the PC board. I'm very disappointed to find that most of the cell phones these days do not have an external antenna connector. Very short-sighted from an RF point of view on the manufacturer's part. I really blame them for not putting a connector on the outside so that people can put an external antenna. The average guy who had a simple antenna on the roof of his car that plugs into an antenna connector on the cell phone would give him a hell of a lot better reception. All of those dropouts you have when you go driving around, most of them would disappear. So somebody ought to start selling cell phones with external RF antenna connectors. We ham radio operators will buy that brand name and that model number. We'll be voting with our pocketbook. If they catch on to what we really need and what we respect when it comes to a good RF reception, they should start building that. Back to you for a final on this one, Tom. KB2.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
KB2CLN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Tom.
Okay, very good, Dick. WB2CLN, and yeah, I'm well aware that a quarter wave at the cell phone frequency is like 1.5 inches, and okay, thanks for that tip. I'll have to, I guess, look for that little connector and drill a tiny hole so I can somehow hook up an external antenna. As far as the Wi-Fi antenna, no, that's for downstate here. I want to be able to walk around, see my friends, and, you know, get into my router. And that's why I wanted to make a collinear vertical. Of course, it's 2400 megahertz. Wi-Fi is pretty tiny. As you know, a half wave is like 2.34 inches, and I was going to go with four half waves. I'm not sure how to handle the phasing stuff. I don't think I can make it in terms of a U, but I guess maybe a single turn coil. I'm not sure because we're dealing with, you know, a half wave is 2.34 inches. Back to you.
Yeah, I think I see where you're going with this one. Again, you've looked at the charts about gain versus number of wavelengths of a collinear antenna, and you say, I want a lot of gain, so I've chosen 2, 3, or 4 half wavelengths. Do not do that. It's the equivalent to a guy putting a high gain collinear antenna, a station master antenna, on top of a sailboat. When the sailboat is parked at the dock and there's no wind blowing, you get beautiful reception. You go out to sea and the sailboat tilts off to one side and it stops working. Because the high gain collinear antenna does its gain by making a pancake pattern. If you could see the signal coming out of that, it is pancake on the horizon. And now you'd have to be holding that antenna absolutely vertical, otherwise it's going to kill you. That the pancake will be above or below the horizon when you tilt it. Keep it simple. The right kind of an external antenna with the right kind of a network that you're talking to will do the job. Don't go for all those extra dBs of gain on a handheld device. You don't want to be restricted into holding it vertical to the nearest plus or minus 5 degrees. Do you see where I'm going on that one, Tom? WB2CLN, K2LIW.
Yeah, I'm aware of that. I was going to mount this Wi-Fi antenna on the roof of the house, and it would be vertical. So that's what I planned on doing. And because I want to be able to have a fairly good range with my Wi-Fi signal. That's for downstate here. Go ahead.
Okay, you've got this collinear antenna on the roof of the house. You've got a cable coming down into the house. And now you want to walk around and have a whole lot of range with your tablet. Is it going to be connected to that cable? Or by some magic, are you now going to be talking from the tablet to some kind of an antenna in the house that talks to the cable, that talks to the antenna on the roof? When it comes to coupling the signal from the tablet to a coupling antenna that goes to the cable, as long as there's only, let me pick a number, an inch of spacing there, it's easy. If you think you're going to walk 10 feet away from that antenna with your tablet, talk to that antenna that goes to the cable, that goes to the roof, that will not work. Is that what you're planning on doing, Tom? I mean, I'm not trying to scare you, but you're walking into a minefield, and I want to tell you where the mines are located. WB2CLN, KQLIW.
The tablet would be going, transmitting to the Wi-Fi antenna. The Wi-Fi antenna is hooked to the router via coax. And I know you'll scream at me when I say RG6U, but if the run is like 25 feet, that's like 2.5 dB loss, no big deal. And I can get it for free, so, you know. Yeah, at that frequency, it's about 2.5 dB for 25 feet loss, and, you know, I can tolerate that, but... it would be, the Wi-Fi antenna would be hooked up to the router, go ahead.
And no, I'm not going to scream at you. RG6 is a fine cable. Quite a bit better than RG59. You buy the right brand. RG6 is a good cable with a well-installed connector. Okay, I think you've got most of the raw data you need. We've got to move on because we promised everybody a brief answer in the first hour. Jim, KD2BHY. What's the latest in, all of a sudden, Great Neck, I think it's Great Neck, is where you live. What's the latest, and how have you figured out how to wire that variable capacitor? You didn't mail me a picture. KD2BHY, K2RIW, go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, I had a couple questions tonight, about the transmitter and stuff. One of my questions was about the variable capacitor. I was going to send you a picture, but my computer wasn't working. I haven't tried anything with it yet, but if I wired it incorrectly, would it damage it?
It's an air variable capacitor. Would you damage it? No way to tell. You'd be amazed how rugged they are, Jim. No, you can't damage the antenna. The worst that'll happen is the circuit won't behave the way you want it to because you haven't chosen the right two terminals on the variable capacitor, air variable capacitor. You could be transmitting into that air variable capacitor and even arcing it over because you're running so many watts. As bad as that sounds and as bad as it looks, for the most part, it's not damaging. So no, don't worry about damaging your variable capacitor. But if you do mail me a picture, I can give you some hints as to how to choose the right two terminals. But most variable capacitors, the whole outer frame and the pivot by which the rotation takes place, that usually is ground. That's one terminal. The other terminal is the set of stationary capacitor plates. The stationary plates is usually the other terminal. And sometimes it's one or maybe even two connections to those. Not that you need two connections, but it's just done to be physically easily adaptable. So the stator plates, the non-moving plates, are one terminal. The ground of the whole frame is the other terminal in most variable capacitors. There are other kinds of variable capacitors, but that's the most popular one that's used on, say, for instance, a AM radio broadcast-type transistor radio. Over to you, Jim. KD2BHY, K2RIW.
I have that, except there are four terminals. There are no terminals connected to the chassis, and there are four terminals connected to the stationary part of the capacitor.
Okay, if you were holding that variable capacitor in your hand, and you try to describe to me where each one of the four terminals goes to, somewhere in there you've got a set of what I call stationary plates, stator plates. You've got a bunch of plates of the variable capacitor, a bunch of sheet metal pieces that are all parallel to each other, sticking up in the air, and as you rotate the shaft, another set of parallel plates meshes with the first set. The ones that move are called the rotor plates. The ones that sit still are called the stator plates. Are you telling me that there's two separate sets of stator plates, and that there's two connections to each set? Is that sort of what you're saying, Jim? Back to you, Jim, KQLIW.
Well, little bit. There's one set of stager plates, but there are four connections to that one set.
Okay. The stator plates, are they in two separate groups? Do some of the connections couple to one of the groups and some of the connections couple to the other group? That's one way they could have done it. Or when you look at the plates, some of those plates are in parallel with each other electronically. Although there are a bunch of parallel plates, somewhere they're all tied together. Are every one of the stator plates all tied together? Or are the two separate groups of stator plates that are tied together? Now back to you, Jim, KQLIW.
It's kind of hard to explain. It looks like they're all tied together, but there are two separate areas where they're tied together.
My recommendation is you just take a guess and wire it. Nothing bad's going to happen. However, if you do mail me a picture, I can give you some hints. So that's about the best that I can recommend, Jim. What else can I tell you?
I'm a dick.
Go ahead, John.
TC2WGB. James, you might want to do it with your own meter. Check from those terminal screws to the rotors and to the stators. You should be able to determine which ones are which.
Thanks, John. And Dick, I had another question if you have any time.
Do you remember, as I told you earlier, a conversation I had a couple of days ago, one of those conversations was with Mike Kilo Delta 2 Alpha Mike Zulu in Seacliff. He has an HTX-202 he wants to give to you, which he thinks has a damaged loudspeaker, and replacing the loudspeaker is very simple. There is another guy who has a Simpson Model 260 volt-ohm milliamp meter that he wants to give to you. I'm not sure, but I think it was Kilo Charlie 2 Quebec Yankee Whiskey. I think it was him, or it could have been
2ZSE.
Okay, it was ZSE. WB2 Zebra Sierra Echo. Is that you, Steve? Go ahead.
No, it's not a slew, but it was Steve.
Okay, Steve, give me your call letters.
No, his call letters are WB2ZSE, and he's offering up the meter for James.
Okay, so it is a Whiskey Bravo 2 Zulu Sierra Echo. He's offering the Simpson meter to you. He's not sure whether or not it needs a new battery for its ohm meter scale, and there's a slim chance that one of the resistors in the ohm meter scale got damaged. That's a fairly easy thing to replace, but that's a very nice meter to have. So ZSE, that Steve, is promising you a Simpson 260, and you can probably find him on QIZ.com and make contact with him. And this man, Mike, KD2AMZ in Seacliff, has this HTX-202, so the price is right. I'll go ahead with your second question, Jim. KD2BHZ, boy, I'm great in great shape the other night. KD2BHY, K2RIW, go ahead, Jim.
I just had another question about the connecting to the antenna to the transmitter that I'm building. It says to wind the antenna four times around the coil, and it says it'd be good to use a half-wave dipole. I'm not really sure how you would wind what with a half-wave dipole four times around the coil. Confused about that.
Yeah, most transmitters and most antennas are really two completely separate components. Most of the antennas we amateurs use, the antenna itself is a 50-ohm impedance if it's tuned correctly and built correctly. And whether the antenna has a 50-ohm load to your transmitter, whether it's a ground plane antenna, a quarter wave, a 5/8 wave, a half wave dipole, a Yagi, there's a zillion kinds of antennas, the transmitter doesn't care. If the transmitter is properly built and made for a 50-ohm load, that's one complete item all by itself. And there's a zillion different kinds of antennas you can connect to it. So there was no In most cases, there's no special way you wind the coil for the impedance matching network of a transmitter because you're using a particular kind of antenna. The transmitter doesn't know what the antenna is. The antenna doesn't know what the transmitter is, if you know what I mean. They're two completely separate items. You can test the transmitter all by itself. You can test the antenna all by itself. So, and I'd like to believe that the schematic diagram you're following for that construction of that transmitter tells you when you wind this particular coil, you use a coil form of this diameter, made out of this kind of material, and you wind this number of turns, and you space those turns wire spacing, or you have them directly connected alongside of each other. It's an enameled wire. Hopefully they describe to you how to construct that coil. But there's nothing special about the way you build the coil just because it's going to a half-wave dipole. Wonder if that makes a little more sense, Jim. KD2BHY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
I was just wondering how you can, like, if I have a half-wave dipole, how would I mean, what part of the dipole would I wind around the coil?
If it's a real half-wave dipole, which you almost always feed with some kind of transmission line. Most of the time we use coax cable, but it could be a twin lead transmission line. But the dipole itself, you're mounting it as high as you can get on your particular piece of property, and you're feeding it with a transmission line. Rarely do we ever put the two together. The exception to that is a handy talkie. Yeah, the handy talkie, the rubber duck antenna, is right on the exact same case, and there's no transmission line in between the two, although you sometimes do put a transmission line from your handy-talkie to your separate antenna that you hold in the other hand. But that's a rare situation. So, and if the rubber duck-like antenna on the transmitter is half-wave versus quarter-wave, yes, there's a different way you do impedance matching in that case, but I'm not sure that that's what you're asking. So give me a few more words as to where is the half-wave dipole located with reference to the transmitter. Are they attached directly to each other with no transmission line in between? That would be very unusual, but maybe that's what you're saying. Back to you, Jim, K2LIW.
If I had the half-wave dipole, I would just wind the coax around the cable?
Wind the coax around the cable. Now I'm confused. Some people make a poor man's balun by making a few turns of coax cable held together with black tape near the center of the dipole. That's a pretty effective balun. And then that transmission line from that poor man's balun comes down into the shack, and the dipole itself is high up in the air. By the way, let me jump back to the last time you and I talked a couple days ago or one day ago. And you told me that you got very high standing wave ratio on every single band where you're using that dipole. That's a bad sign. From the fact that you only hear one strong guy on the 20-meter band and haven't gotten any replies yet, tells me that the strong piece of evidence that you've got a major thing wrong with your antenna. I'm beginning to think there's a short circuit at the antenna or a short circuit at the connector. And that could be confirmed with an ohmmeter. So that particular antenna needs some looking at for sure. But now, the antenna, a half-wave dipole, you almost never wrap it or wrap its coax cable into a coil of the transmitter. Yes, you wrap it into a coil to make a balun at the antenna, but then there's a transmission line coming down in the shack. So I'm a bit confused with that combination of words, Jim. Back to you, Jim, K2LIW.
I meant at the end, one end of the coax is going to the antenna, and on the other end, how do I just wind that coax around the coil that I made for the transmitter?
That leaves some time for the Houston Inc. RYY is trying to get in.
Why?
Oh, was that MMY that I just heard trying to get in? Go ahead.
Yeah, Roger that, Dick. He's confusing two different things. Are you hearing me? I just want to check.
Yes, I'm hearing you. And, Jim, the the coax cable that is the transmission line going to the antenna. Usually the end of that cable in the shack, you put a connector on it, DNC type UHF or whatever, you put a connector on that end of the cable, and that connector will screw into a similar connector on the chassis of the transmitter. Almost nobody takes the coax cable from the antenna and brings it straight into the transmitter and wraps it in some way around the coil. I think almost nobody does that, and that may be a confusion. MMY, go right ahead with your suggestion. K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger that. The circuit, that the piece of wire that's being wrapped around the coil is part of the circuit that's being built. It's just an inductively coupled piece of magnet wire. You're never wrapping any kind of cable around to make that antenna. That's just the way the antenna is made. For now, it doesn't have to be hooked up to anything. It will oscillate by itself, you know, like for a half a mile, just the way it is. Later on, you can connect it to a piece of, to a real antenna just by connecting one end of that antenna to the center conductor on an antenna and the other end to the ground of the whole circuit. But right now, you don't have to connect it to any kind of antenna. You're not wrapping a dipole around the film can is what they're using. You're just inductively coupling a simple piece of magnet wire around the existing coil in the circuit. I think Dick probably understands it now.
That was Ray, KC2MMY. Ray, are you familiar with the exact transmitter and the article that Jim is following that he's building? Are you familiar with the exact rig that he's building, Ray? Back to you, Ray, K2LAW.
Yeah, Roger that, Dick. I built the circuit and I suggested it to him. I'm the one who sent him the link for the circuit, so I'm familiar with every part in the circuit, and that's all there is to it, to build. It's only one transistor, you know, half a watt little transmitter. It doesn't need to be hooked to any antenna right now until he gets it working. The antenna he's talking about is part of the circuit. It's not really an antenna, external antenna. It's an inductively coupled, you know, magnetic piece of wire.
Okay, so Jim, if I understand correctly, you're following now the suggestion of Ray, who pointed you to a particular article. With what Ray just told you now, do you have a little bit better understanding for what you're about to do, Jim? KD2BHY, K2LIW.
Yeah, I understand now. Back to net, KD2BHY.
Dick?
Go ahead, John.
Dick, if you remember, James sent you a diagram and asked you a question about that RF circuit. He saw two coils, and that second coil is the inductive coupling that he's talking about.
Yeah, you're assuming I remember. That was a couple of months ago. That was 150 emails ago. I don't keep this all straight. I mean, each person who writes to me assumes that he's the only person writing. Each person calls thinks that they're the only person calling. And so I'm a little bit buried. You'll have to forgive me, you guys. So you're allowed to come back and ask the question as many times as you want to, Jim, and good luck with that project, with that transmitter. We're going to move on to Steve now. I think it's KB2 Golf Lima Tango. Go right ahead, Steve, K2RIW.
WA2RYY.
We heard you, Joe, and you're on the list. Steve, KD2 Golf Lima Tango, are you still there, Steve?
Okay, Dick, this is KB2GLI, Gulf Lima, India. I'm coming in through Echolink. Yeah, my question, I wanted your opinion on backup DC power sources for, let's say, field day or emergency use or whatever. I'm just wondering how effective these battery jumper kits that you see, let's say, in Walmart, might be suited for that type of operation. I seem to remember like about 15 years ago you were talking about deep cycle batteries and using something like that. I don't particularly want to build anything. I'd like to just be able to pull something off the shelf. So if you can give me some feedback on that, I'd be appreciated.
Yeah, interesting you should ask that question, Steve. I was just in Home Depot yesterday or the day before, and I saw this handheld thing that looks to me like, it's about 2 or 3 inches thick, and I guess about 8 inches square, with a big handle on one side and a bunch of meters on the front, and it's called a 300-amp battery booster or jumper for an automobile. And so it's got an internal battery, it's got an internal charging circuit, and yes, I had the impression that that circuit can dish out for a very brief period of time 300 amperes into your automobile by way of its jumper cables to start your automobile. You're now sort of asking, obviously you don't need 300 amperes. To use 3 amps or 30 amps would be more than enough. The real question here is not what's the maximum current that battery can push out, but for how long it can put out your particular amount of current. What is the number of ampere hours of that battery? When I stand by a second. I'm looking at the circuit at Home Depot, and I remember it wasn't a very big price. I don't remember now. Maybe it was $69 or something like that. But I remember studying everything on the outside of the box, reading all the information. And yes, it is definitely oriented toward jump-starting an automobile with a dead battery. But nowhere did they give you a hint as to how many ampere hours that battery is. When I look at the size of the package and I can make my mental image as to how much volume there is there in that battery, I'm assuming it's something like a gel cell inside. I'll be amazed if that gel cell has got more than 5 or 10 ampere hour capability. So if your transmitter is going to draw, let me pick a number, 10 amperes, then you're going to be killing that battery in a fraction of an hour, so to speak. So it's the ampere hours you've got to study. There's one other thing you've got to worry about, and that is gel cell-like batteries and lead-acid batteries, in general, when you discharge them beyond the 50% point, you're doing damage. You're sulfating it, you're changing the plating of the plates. I'm not quite sure what all goes on, but after that, the number of ampere hours the battery has is definitely deficient, with one possible exception. There is this very fancy charging-like circuit called Battery Minder that the guys in Canada have been telling us about, where you take a battery that has been damaged in that manner, and apparently it can completely restore the battery to normal operation, this very fancy Battery Minder circuit. So as I see it, I don't have an exact answer for you, as you can tell, Steve, but the main thing you're looking for is how many amps from how many hours can that battery dish out? Let me drop. And by way of the owner's manual for your particular transmitter, you'll know how many amps it draws in the receiver mode, how many amps it draws in the transmitter mode, and you can start figuring out what percentage of the time am I transmitting, what percentage of the time am I receiving, and is that going to be enough hours? And one other minor thing to worry about, and that is my particular 2-meter all-mode rig, a Kenwood 751, I think it is, 751A, I've noticed that in the sideband mode, it wants to see 12.05 volts or greater. If you go down to 12.0 volts, the synthesizer starts breaking up and it starts sounding horrible. So some transmitters cannot tolerate a small amount of undervoltage. That rig, the Kenwood 751 2-meter all mode, is intended for mobile service. And in mobile service, when the engine is running, the battery has 13.8 volts on it, supplied by the alternator. Turn off the automobile and continue running it from that car battery. And with the jumping, with the voltage drop I get from my normal wiring to that rig when I'm at a portable site, that rig starts giving me trouble. So you've got to worry about whether or not your particular rig, if this is the best of all worlds, your rig would work beautifully all the way down to 11 volts. You'd have no real problem. So what's the minimum voltage your rig works well? How many ampere hours does the battery you feel like buying able to supply? And is that going to give you enough hours of receiving and transmitting service? I haven't given you an answer, but at least I've given you some of the raw ingredients of the problem as you see it, Steve. KB2 and GLI, T2LIW in the TechNet.
WS2N, I've used that battery a lot.
Okay, here's a man who's been there and done it, Steve. Stand by. Go right ahead, Paul. Tell us your experience and what brand name you bought and how many dollars. Where did you buy it? You got it, Paul.
I have two of them. One older one, oh, it's got to be 20 years old when they first came out. It was called Boosted. Kmart had them. And that was probably about $39 then. And that thing actually did say on it 17 amp hours. That's what they claim. And years ago, I don't know, 15, 10 or years ago or so, I used to try to do field day from the backyard. And I hooked up a bunch of car batteries. But I use this thing also. And I would run the Kenwood 440, but not at 100 watts. I'd run it at 50 watts, you know, try to keep the power down. And with the big car batteries, I used to get, you know, 5, 6, 7 hours sometimes easy. And then I would throw this thing in there, and I would get three and a half, 4 hours, depending on how much I was sending. You know, your transmitting is going to eat up all your power, and mostly CW. I always worked a CW with the, when I was doing that in the backyard. So it lasts a long time. Let me drop it. I've had, you know, I have the other one by Sears now. That's, they call that the 750. And I believe they're 59. I got mine on sale for like 49 or something a couple of few years ago. And I see they still sell them for 59. And I had these two things all through Hurricane Sandy, operated a bunch of radios, transmitted left and right on my HT on it, was able to recharge cell phones and all of that. I'm sure if you hooked up an electric heater like they sell in Harbor Freight, you know, they have a defroster heater type of thing for your car, I'm sure it's going to kill the battery real quick. But if you're going to run radios and rechargeable flashlights and all of that, I was able to actually go through 6 days on and off using these things. Back to you, Dave.
Boy, that's good news, Paul. And when you said you got 3 hours out of that booster thing, at the end of the 3 hours, what made you stop? Did you go below, let me pick a number, 11.5 volts, and your rig was not working correctly? And when you deeply discharged to that degree, when you recharged it, did it come back to full life? So how did you determine end of life of your battery booster thing, and how well did it recover when you recharged it? WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, well, with Kenwood 440, you know, the HF rig, it's really easy. The display starts blinking out on you as you're transmitting. You know, now when you're receiving, it looks okay, and then all of a sudden you key down and you start to see the lights go blink, blink, like going off, you know, cycling real quick. So you're going to unkey and so you try not to do any damage. And that happens with, you know, with the big car batteries too, of course. When they run down, you know, that's what happens. So I don't need to hook a meter up or anything. You just watch it. As you're transmitting, you see the lights just flip down on you. So that's what happens with that. No problem. And recharging, well, that thing does take a long time. You know, I plug that thing in and maybe 12, 13, 14 hours later, I would say that it would be fully charged, being dead.
I heard a very noisy signal saying, I've got a comment. I'll go to you in a second. One of the things I've noticed with gel cell-like batteries is that if you deeply discharge them, sometimes you try to recharge them for the first 4 or 6 hours, nothing happens. And all of a sudden it sort of catches on and starts really accepting the charge. So you got to worry about that. The person who had a comment, speak to us very slowly, give us your call letters, and go ahead with your comment. K2LIW.
Kind of disposition?
Something about disposition. You've got to slow down your speech, and please give us your call letters and your name, sir. Go right ahead.
Kilo Bravo 2, Mike Alpha Romeo, name here is Gabe. How do you copy this position?
Gabe, we're copying you quite well right now, so go right ahead.
Okay, most of these silver acid batteries have a full voltage rating of 12.9 volts
and a discharge voltage of 11.4. Blade power in general, when the battery is 50%, is you divide, it's a 1.5 volt spread. So 12.9 minus 7.5 volts will give you the voltage at a 50% capacity when the battery is open circuited. Back to you.
Okay, you talked about minus 7.5 volts, and that doesn't make sense. So run that by again, Gabe.
I'm sorry. 0.75 volts, because when you add it, it equals 1.5. When you, okay, excuse me, it's half of 1.5. You take half of 1.5 and subtract it from 12.9, and that gives you the battery when it's 50%, when it's open circuited.
Okay, that makes a lot more sense. So if 12.9 is where it starts off with when it's fully charged, and I take 0.75 away from that, it'll be 12.15. So when I get down to 12.15 at normal room temperature, I think you're saying most likely the lead-acid battery is at 50%, is what I think Gabe is saying. Okay. Hopefully, Steve, that's giving you a lot more information. Steve, you're listed as being in Ocala, Florida. I wonder if that's where you are right now, or are you talking to us by Echolink? KB2, Golf Lima, India, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Yes, you're correct. It's Ocala, Florida. You've addressed my concerns. I was aware of the ampere hours. I didn't have any spec on the batteries at all, so I didn't know. It says that you can draw 90 amps for 5 seconds, and that's all that I had to work with. But what I was concerned with was bleeding the battery out slowly and then not being able to recover the charge because it's basically, I think, a sealed lead-acid battery, and you've got to treat them as such. It's not the deep cycle battery, recreational battery that you once were speaking about. Go ahead.
So as long as you choose a brand similar to the one that Paul, WS2N, was telling you about, when it comes to approximately 3 hours of operation with his Kenwood 440 running at the 50-watt level, he seemed to be fairly happy with it. So at least that's one piece of good news. Now, as I said, the one that I saw at Home Depot said 300 ampere capability. Yours says 90. So there may be a significant difference in size and portability and so on. It's another one of these situations where everybody wants the circuit to be super small, and sometimes they're making some ridiculous sacrifices in performance in the process of doing that. So, hopefully, when you find what looks like a desirable brand of this battery booster thing, I'd like to believe when you read the model number and the brand name and you go to that manufacturer's website, I'd like to believe you'd eventually find out what is the ampere hours of that battery, even if it's not marked on the box. Or maybe there's a way of finding out what is the model number of the actual battery inside, and then again you can find out how many ampere hours that's good for. So I think that's the approach you got to take, Steve. Any other final words, Steve? KB2GLI, K2LIW?
Comment.
6WS1.
Go ahead, Paul, with your comment.
I like the newer ones because you can leave them plugged in all the time at home, for instance. You could just leave them plugged in. It's just on a trickle charge, it's meant to do that. You could leave it in and then take it out with you if you want. With the older ones, when I had maybe 20-year-old one, you know, they tell you don't overcharge it, leave it in, you know, so many hours, and that type of thing. But the new ones, like by Sears, the diehard ones, I think are really good. I mean, I don't do that. I put it in the trunk, but I just religiously recharge them every 2 months. You know, you have to have that ability. You know, some people will throw it in the trunk and, you know, a year later they'll pull it out and they need it. Maybe it won't work, but, you know, I had to make that comment. You got to be that type of person to recharge it every couple of months.
KD2AWD on a comment.
AWZ, go right ahead. Start off with your name, sir.
The call sign is KD2 Alpha Whiskey Victor. The name is Greg. I have a comment on the battery.
Go ahead with your comment on the battery, Greg.
I have two. They're both made by an outlet called I got them in Pep Boys. One puts out 300 amp charge, boost rather, and the other puts out a 450. On the specs that I've got, the smaller one is an 8 ampere hour battery, and the larger one is an 18 ampere hour battery, if that helps you guys out.
Okay, your signal was very noisy, Greg, but you're saying that the smaller one was 8 ampere hours, and the larger one was 18 ampere hour battery. So that gives you some possible size guesses. But I think you do want to check on the ampere hours before you lay down your money. And when your owner's manual on your transmitter should tell you how many amperes it draws in the transmit mode and the receive mode, and therefore you'll be able to do a calculation as to how many hours you're good for. Back to you, Steve. KB2GLI.
Comment.
Who is the person with comment?
This case is 2LSB. Just a quick thought. If you Google replacement battery for the particular model of charger pack, you may be able to get that information on amp hour.
Okay, OSB, sounds like a good thing to do. So the replaceable battery, hopefully, is the exact same size in ampere hours. Back to you, Steve, KB2GLI, K2LAW.
Okay, Dick, thank you for your time. I'll make this the final and let you move on. One thing I could always do is open the device, look inside, there may be some markings on the battery, or maybe even some part numbers. But everything that I've been hearing sounds good. You know, you can't get something for nothing, but this could work. Discharge cell phones, use an HT in an emergency, and you can leave it plugged in all the time, so that could be my second power supply. All right, I'll 73 here, and I'll let you move on with your net. Thank you for your help.
Very fine, Steve. And Steve, after you do buy and use and say you like it or don't like it, come back and let us know how it all worked out. Next person on my list was Freddie, KB2, Victor Bravo, November. And typical of those guys in New York City, Freddie is a real fast talker. Slow yourself down a little bit, Freddie, so we can catch up with you. KB2 VBN, K2LIW. Go ahead, Freddie. Okay, maybe Freddie's not there. Next person on the list was John, Whiskey Kilo 2 Juliet. Go right ahead, John, K2LIW.
Evening there, fellas. WKTJ, I just want to ask. I heard some chatter about the North and South Pole. Are we in a transition of a magnetic field? And if so, how is that going to affect us electronically and otherwise? Could you give us a rundown on that, Dick? K2RAW, WK2J.
I'm not an expert in this one, John. I do know that when I bought a magnetic sensing machine back in the middle 70s, a Gauss meter, I do remember that in Farmingdale, where I was using it, the Earth's magnetic field measured 450 milligauss. I know that the Earth's magnetic field has been slowly decreasing since then, and so there are a number of people predicting that it's either the North Pole is going to move and or we're going into we're beginning the next cycle of a magnetic field reversal. There are people making that prediction. I've heard that much. And how soon it's going to happen, I don't know. And when we do have a magnetic field reversal, does the magnetic field of the Earth really go to zero and then come back with the opposite polarity? I doubt it. Let me drop. I think what happens is it goes to a slightly lower number. The location of the North Pole and the South Pole propagates quite a bit, and then it comes back, so to speak. So I'm having trouble believing that with our molten core of the Earth, that's really going to go to zero. I doubt it very highly, and I don't think it's going to happen tomorrow. I think it's going to happen very slowly in a predictable manner. The good news is that the Earth's magnetic field is the main reason we have that Van Allen belt and of those of millions of pounds per second of solar wind particles, charged particles, boiling off from the sun. They come streaming by the Earth at something in the vicinity of 1,000,000 miles an hour. They get trapped by that Earth's magnetic field. They go into that Van Allen belt, and they bounce back and forth in there. And the ones that hit the North Pole give you the aurora, and the South Pole give you the other aurora. And so that's why you see the aurora. And without that magnetic field, we'd possibly have the problem that's going on with Mars. Mars probably used to have a magnetic field. It lost it as it cooled off. The core is no longer molten. Let me drop. And without the magnetic field on Mars, and Mars also being a smaller planet with a smaller amount of gravity, you put it all together. Less gravity to hold on to its atmosphere, no magnetic field. The solar wind slowly peeled away the atmosphere on Mars. That's one of the explanations for why Mars has so little atmosphere right now. It got peeled away by less gravity and no magnetic field to protect it, the shield that you get from that magnetic field. So the Earth has reversed its magnetic field a whole lot of times in the past. I think at least 5 times and maybe a bigger number. And from my understanding, the periodic mass extinctions that have occurred on the Earth are not correlated with the reversals of the magnetic field. The extinctions were some other phenomenon, like a comet or a asteroid striking the Earth and creating a nuclear winter. So that's what little I know. I'm not losing a whole lot of sleep over this one, John. I wonder if anyone else on frequency knows more about the current status of the Earth's magnetic field. Is it decreasing? Are we heading for a reversal? If you have any smarts on that area, please give us your call letters and name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2QMU, comment question.
Okay, you said it super fast. I think I heard QMU, Quebec Mike Uniform is what I think I heard. Give me a whole call, give me your name, and proceed with your comment.
Bell, M2QMU, my question is, what about the Curie temperature? Don't magnetic metals lose their magnetism when they're molten?
Okay, you didn't give me your name like you promised you were going to. QNU, I think it was Quebec November Uniform is what it sounds like. When it comes to a permanent magnet you hold in your hand, made out of neodymium or alnico or whatever, those kind of magnets, yes, they all have a Curie temperature. You heat them up, you scramble those magnetic domains, and it loses its magnetism. That's an entirely different magnetic process than what goes on in the Earth. The Earth's magnetic field is made by a molten core that's in motion. That, in turn, is the equivalent of charged particles moving somewhat like the solenoid coil you've got on an electromagnet, and that, by some magic process, is generating a magnetic field. So the magnetic field of the Earth depends on a rotating molten core. That's my understanding. So don't worry about the Curie temperature of the Earth and its magnetic field. It's coming from a very different process. Quebec November Uniform, question mark. Please tell me your name, K2RIW.
Maybe I have a problem with my PTT button. This is Bill, N2QMU, clear.
Okay, Bill. Out of curiosity, is it Quebec Mike Uniform? Is that what I'm hearing for your call letters?
Yes.
Okay, Bill, thank you for your comment. So I wouldn't lose a whole lot of sleep on this one, John, but at least you now know a little bit more of what to look for. I'm pretty sure that people who own a Gauss meter today are measuring a smaller number than the 450 milligauss I used to measure in the mid-70s. I think it's like 20% lower today. So there is apparent evidence that the Earth's magnetic field, as sensed on Long Island, is decreasing. But at the rate of decrease, if I look at the fact that that was 40 years ago when I made that measurement, I don't think you and I have a great deal to worry about during our lifetime. And because the mass extinctions and the Earth's magnetic field reversal seem to be unrelated, again, I don't think the way the Earth does it is troublesome. WK2J, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Okay, very informative, Dick. Thank you very much. I'll hand it back to you. K2RIW, WK2J.
mind, John. I said in the beginning, I gave you the caveat. I'm far from an expert in that area. However, this is a peer-reviewed TechNet, so to speak, by way of the website everybody can go to and listen to the recordings of past TechNets by going to www.amateurradio.tangovictor. And that website is done by this very enthusiastic guy, Mike Perry, KC2NJI. Except for the last TechNet, last week's TechNet, the first hour, Mike told us that his antenna was not properly connected. The second hour, 57 minutes of it are there. And then the last 3 minutes turns into a repetitive one sentence that I said, and the next 3 hours of that recording of that sentence over and over again. So some kind of an error occurred in Mike's computer that does that recording in the playback. So last week's TechNet does have a little bit of a problem. But for the most part, people who review the TechNet tell us the errors that John and Dick occasionally make. we don't have a 1,000 batting average, and so what I've given you on magnetics, it's not traceable to the bureau yet, John. So wait until other people correct us if we've made some big errors on that one. Next person who signed in was Mel, K2 Mike Charlie. And Mel, what's keeping you busy these days? K2 LIW and the TechNet.
Okay, let me say good evening to you there, Dick, and to other members of the TechNet. Well, today I want to talk about generators, so I still have some questions as to whether or not it pays to resurrect this 1986 model, given that it's got a 1 gallon gas tank and all the other problems associated with it. But the subject of tonight's interest to me is, well, let me start by saying that my daughters gave me and my wife an iPad, and Optimum gave me a Kindle. And for that purpose, since I wanted to do printing from these items, I purchased a new printer, happened to be a Brother printer, and I was able to install it properly on my wireless network. Print to it from both my laptops, and I could also, I downloaded a app from Brother onto the iPad, but I may be wrong, but I got the impression that that particular app is only good for Apple-based mobile devices. Kindle is something else. I believe it's Android, and I'd like to find out if anybody in the TechNet has any specific information as to whether or not this same app can be used with a Kindle or whatever else I could do. So that's the question, Dick.
I sure hope we have somebody who is computer savvy on the net that can help you answer your question, Mel. Maybe my son, also KB2IQN, who I think is on frequency, will be able to help you. I'm very light on computer knowledge. I claim to be an RF person, and computers are something that, unfortunately, in that area, I'm only an appliance operator, if you know what I mean. So, anyone on frequency who can help Mel with his question on the interfacing between his iPad, his Kindle, and printing and storage of data, give us your call letters and name right now, K2LIW in the TechNet.
WS2N. I have the Kindle HD, but I don't understand the question.
Okay. Paul, sounds like you've done some of what Mel is doing. Why don't you word what information you need to give him the next level of answer? So tell us what you would like to know in order to help Mel with his question. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, okay. You said an app for the Kindle. Which app is he trying to do? And the only ones I get are through the Amazon store. If you try to go through Google Play, it's a headache. Back to you.
Yeah, but the question is, which app would I use for the Kindle in conjunction with a Brother printer, which does have cloud capabilities? I guess that's the terminology. I guess anyone who is completely familiar with the term cloud printing could probably set me in the right direction. Do I have that gentleman? I'm sorry, I missed your name. WS2, go ahead.
Okay, the name is Paul. Well, I print a lot of things from my Kindle, but I don't use an app. What I do is I just email it over to myself, and then I go on to the other, you know, I have another computer, or the base computer, I would call it, and bring in my own email, and I just print it out. So that's what I do. I don't even know if there, I guess there's an app to go directly to another printer or something, but that's all I do. Here's Paul, back to you.
Now, let me repeat what I think. So, there's the iPad, the Kindle printing, Brother printer, and cloud printing is what Mel wants to do. Any with any further information on that combination, give us your call letters and name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. I was a little bit afraid of that one. So right now we don't have much of a further answer for you as I see it, Mel. The group that gathers here, with a couple of rare exceptions, are not always the computer mavens. K2MC, K2RIW.
Okay. All right, thank you, Paul, for your suggestion. But, yeah, I know I could always do it that way, but to me, that's like cheating. No, I was able to get the app for the iPad. That one I could print directly to my new Brother printer without having to go through an intermediate computer. I just want to do the same thing using the Kindle, and I'm not quite sure if the same app would apply, but I got the impression that that particular one is good for only Apple-based units. But anyhow, I appreciate the efforts of both you, Paul, and Dick. Thank you very much, and I'll toss it back to you, Dick.
Wait, Dick, does he have a word processing program? Is that what he needs?
You've got it, Mel.
No, I was waiting for that. No, it's just a matter, it has nothing to do with a word processing program or anything like that. It's anything that you would want to print from a computer to, to send from a computer to a printer, as you do now with your laptop or desktop, you could also do with a mobile device, a tablet, an iPad, Kindle, and iPhones as well, and other smartphones. For whatever reason, it doesn't necessarily require a word processor, though. You can print a picture or anything you see on your screen directly to the printer, just as you do with your home computer.
Oh, okay. I have no reason for that. I just use the word processing program, WSP, and I could forward pictures, whatever it is, and then I could just, like I said before, email it to myself and do it that way. So, actually, I'll look for that program that you're talking about. It sounds good. They should have it for the Kindle, I would think. Back to you, Dick.
W2PMP.
WB2PMP. Baker Mike Papa is what it sounds like. Start with your name, sir, and please give us some information on this one. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Hi, Dick. It's Whiskey 2 Bravo Mike Papa. The name is Joe. We've spoken many times. I know it's hard to remember names, and I know you don't remember faces. But anyway, what kind of machine is hooked up to the printer, and I can direct them to the right program to use?
You got it, Mel.
Boy, that's a long pause before the phone. I don't know whether it makes a difference what particular computer I have on. I happen to be using a HP laptop, which is what I have been using for at least a year now. Prior to that, I have a Toshiba laptop. But the idea is that we just got these two tablets within the last few months, and I just want to be able to go directly to my printer, which happens to be a Brother printer, although that might not make any difference. It's a new vintage, which supposedly has cloud printing capability.